They split up at 3. Kate and Cora, along with Neri and Serge, headed back to the Air Temple, while Anne and Azana went uptown to the Fire Lord Zuko Firebending Academy to get in a couple of hours' practice. They timed their session to end at 5:30, so that Anne would have time to head over to the train station and meet the 5:45 arrival of the Republic City Limited. "Have fun at the train station," said Azana with a yawn and a stretch as they left the academy. "Me, I'm heading home. If the streetcars are on time, I can get another 2 hours sleep before my last night shift at the Phoenix House." Anne looked surprised. "Your last?" "Well, not ever," Azana qualified. "But I don't work the hotel job during the MLB season." She smiled wryly. "You spend 3 or 4 hours a day throwing your chi at the wall. It's hard to be that nice to people all night." Anne laughed and said she could see where that would be a challenge. They parted amiably at the street corner with promises that they'd see each other at the arena tomorrow. And then Azana ran to catch the uptown streetcar, while Anne headed east toward Central City Station. Having only avoided getting hopelessly sidetracked by the street market outside the station by a supreme effort of will, she was on the platform when the train arrived. Not much to her surprise, she spotted Amy Pond first. At nearly 6 feet tall, the Scottish redhead stood out in most crowds, but especially here in Dicho, where, even in the cosmopolitan hub of all the world's cultures, virtually nobody had hair that color. Seeing Anne's wave, Amy grinned and made her way over through the streams of other detraining passengers with Noll and her boyfriend, Rory Williams, in tow. Rory had little choice in the matter, since he and Amy were carrying a compact but heavy chest between them, each holding onto one of its sturdy iron handles. Anne smiled a little wider at the sight of it. She'd seen it presented to Corwin in the audience chamber of none other than the Dragon King of Alfheim himself, and it was a potent reminder of that epic day out. Behind the chest and its bearers, Noll was in the curious position of looking the least out of place of the three. His shock of white hair stood out a bit, but he was dressed the most like a local, in blues and whites that suggested one of the water tribes. "Hello," said Rory cheerfully. "Fancy meeting you here," added Amy. "Hi, guys," Anne replied. "You're right on time." "Exactly on time," agreed Noll with a satisfied smile, observing the tall pedestal clock in the middle of the platform. "Ah, you've got to love Republic Rail." They passed customs without any problem at all. Here, as in Psycho, nobody showed the slightest interest in the mysterious ruined box, which Amy seemed to find a bit disappointing. And were walking across the station's bustling main concourse when Noll asked Anne, "How's everybody been the last couple of days?" "Nothing, urgent going on yet, I hope." Anne shook her head, grinning. "Nope, not yet, but we're all on the edge of our seats." She held half of one of the station's many bronze double doors for them, while Noll got the other half, and added, as Amy and Rory emerged onto the station's wide entry plaza, "Welcome to Republic City." "Thanks," said Amy, looking around with evident pleasure at the square and the market stalls lapping like tidewaters at its far edge, past the great statue of Fire Lord Zuko. "Sure has changed since the last time, eh, Rory?" "You guys have been here before?" asked Anne, surprised. "Well, no, not to the city specifically," Rory told her, shooting Amy a look the younger duelist couldn't read. "I don't suppose you've brought a dolly?" he asked, indicating the chest with his free hand. "This is getting a bit heavy." Anne regarded him thoughtfully for a moment. He and Amy glanced at each other, then the chest, which suddenly seemed to have become substantially less heavy. Then they both turned back to Anne, who was giving them an enigmatic little smile. Sorry, afraid not, she said, as if nothing at all unusual was happening. But we've got something much better on the way. She looked up at the clock set into the station's facade. Any second now. Just as she said it, as if summoned by her voice, a sky bison swooped over the buildings off to the right and landed in front of them. Nall blinked at the colorfully dressed figure who alighted gracefully from the bison's head and trotted toward them, smiling cheerfully. It took him a second or two to recognize her. When he'd last seen her, she had been just a tiny thing, a little short for her age and scrawny, with long, unkempt dark hair and a perpetually timid expression. Now she was tall, and so thin she seemed even taller, but not puny. Instead, her slenderness somehow gave her an air of wiry indestructibility. Her hair was mostly gone, revealing the entirety of her master airbender's arrow tattoo, and far from timid, her expression now was one of cheerful, confident aplomb. "Greetings, travelers," the young airbender declared, presenting the group with a fist-to-palm bow and a wide smile. "Welcome. My name is Nima, and this is Vayu."
"Rumph," said Vayu.
"We're here to guide you to Air Temple Island today," Nima went on. She noticed Nall staring at her and gave him a curious look, her cheeks reddening slightly. "Yes?" "Nima," he blurted. "Little Nima?" Then, seeing the confounded look she was giving him, he grinned, dropped his duffel bag, and held out his arms wide, declaring, "It's me, Nall." Nima frowned. "Nall," she said. "That's him. Wait. Your eyes." Her face lit up, the wide smile returning, and she darted forward to embrace him. "Nall, welcome back." Stepping back, she looked him up and down, then gave him a little smirk. "And I thought I had a growth spurt." "No kidding," said Nall, picking up his bag again. "Look at you. Not sure about the hairdo, though." Nima's cheeks colored again. "It's growing back," she said. "I had to shave it to get my arrow, that's all." She turned to Rory and Amy. "That looks heavy. Would you like a hand getting it aboard?"
Yes, please," said Rory.
"Be careful," Amy cautioned her. "It's hot and fragile."
"Don't worry," said Nima cheerfully. "I won't even touch it."
Then she took what looked at first to be a fighting stance, concentrated for a second, and conjured a miniature cyclone out of nowhere. This, guided by graceful, precise movements of her long, slender hands, lifted the chest from between its two bearers and conveyed it neatly to a spot at the back of the broad, platform-like saddle on Vayu's back, then dissipated. "There," she said. "There are tie-downs in the compartment at the back of the saddle, if you'd like to make it extra secure. The weather's very calm today, and I doubt there'll be any trouble on the short flight back to the island. All aboard!" It was a very short flight back to the island. Vayu, Nima explained once they were on their way, was the swiftest of all the bison based permanently at the central air temple. Even loafing along at what was for him a leisurely pace, they were on Air Temple Island in just minutes. While the ground crew raced out to take care of business, Nima lofted the egg chest gently to the ground on another of her miniature tornadoes, then jumped down to find that the youngsters were already taking charge of their new guests as well. As she climbed down, N was amused to see Gatso and one of the other airbender boys, about the same age or a little younger, having a bit of a foot race to see who would get to help Amy with her rucksack. The other boy won, elbowing his way in front of Gyatso with a big grin and piping, "Welcome to Air Temple Island. I'm Tenzin, and he's nobody important. I'll be happy to show you to your quarters. May I take your bag?" Amy blinked, then smiled, unshouldering the pack and handing it over. Tenzin covered any surprise he might have felt at its weight well, hoisted it onto his back, and turned to go.
This way.
You guys go ahead and get situated, Nall told them. We'll meet back here in an hour. I think the plan is for us all to head back to town for dinner.
Works for me, Rory agreed, following after Tenzin and Amy.
Are you a firebender? The boy asked Amy as he led the way across the courtyard toward the dormitories.
Or a fire spirit? Your hair is amazing.
After a moment's consideration, he added matter-of-factly, You're probably the most beautiful woman in the world. Amy went a little bit red.
Well, thank you, she said, entirely disarmed by the cheerfully candid way he'd said it.
Hey, now, Rory objected mildly.
Boy, you better not be disagreeing with him, matey, Amy warned him.
Off to one side of their path, a young girl in air acolyte robes stood with her arms folded, frowning, as she overheard Tenzin's remarks.
You really need to work on your detachment, Tenzin, she scolded him.
Not a master, don't have to yet, Tenzin retorted cheerfully. The girl sighed, rolling her eyes, then put out a hand to intercept Rory as he tried to follow Tenzin and Amy past her.
Not so fast, champ, she said. You're a boy.
She pointed to a different building.
Your quarters are over there.
Rory looked at the building, then at her, then at Amy, and sighed.
Oh, just like being back at school, he said, then nodded with an air of resignation and went on.
Righto.
I'll show you a room you can use. The girl added, as if conceding a point.
Amy grinned.
See you later, champ.
Don't you start, Mrs. Williams, said Rory with a wry smile, and then he trundled his rolling suitcase off toward the men's quarters.
What's your name? He asked his frowning little guide after a few paces.
I'm Rory.
Sita, the girl replied curtly.
Then, without any preamble at all, she asked,
Is it just me, or is Tenzin the biggest dope who ever walked the face of the world?
Rory looked slightly taken aback by this inquiry, then replied,
I'm sure I don't know. I've only just gotten here.
Sita gave a long, suffering sigh.
Figures you'd take his side, she said. Boys.
Back where Vayu had landed, Nall stood by Anne and watched the crew removing the bison's saddle and beginning to brush him, marveling, as Corwin had earlier in the day, at the speed and precision with which they worked. Gyatso, who seemed to have taken no particular offense to being cut out by Tenzin, pitched in with the rest of them. While they stood watching, they were joined by Anthy, Utna, and Corwin, who greeted them cheerfully and confirmed that going to town for dinner was still the plan. Nall eyed Makoto on Anthy's shoulder and remarked,
This guy's muscling in on my turf here.
Krrrt!
Makoto wondered, tilting his head inquisitively.
Yeah, I mean you, Nall replied.
Let's see your permit, pal. You need a license to sit on ladies' shoulders around here. And I don't remember seeing you apply for one.
Now be fair, Nall, I have two, Anthy pointed out, smiling.
And you're not sitting on either one like that anyway, she added archly.
Well, I can fix that, said Nall. But before he could act on that declaration, another teenage airbender arrived.
Trailed by waves of long, dark hair, she came zipping down from the main temple by air scooter, then jumped off to slide stylishly to a halt in front of the bison.
Hello, everyone, Lakpa said brightly.
Oh, Corwin, you're back.
She wagged a chiding finger at him.
You ran away to town Friday night without even saying hello to anyone. It was very rude.
She nudged her younger sister with an elbow.
Nima was crushed, weren't you, Neat?
She trailed off as she noticed the white-haired, red-eyed young man standing by Anthy. She didn't think she knew him, but, wide-eyed, she gave the impression that she'd very much like to change that.
"Who is this?" she went on.
Nall, for his part, was staring at her with equal puzzlement. Then his eyebrows went up and he blurted,
"Lakpa?"
If Nall had found the change in Nima's appearance surprising, that in her elder sister's was downright shocking. When last he had seen Lakpa, she'd been at the all-elbows-and-knees stage herself, but unlike Nima, she appeared to have grown out of it with a vengeance. Even her deliberately undecorative air-nomad clothes couldn't hide that. He was so shocked, in fact, that he unconsciously reverted to his old default flying cat form. He'd been queuing that action up when she arrived, and it was a standard part of Option B in his fight-or-flee response anyway. Seeing this, Lakpa drew back for a moment, startled. Then, seeing what he had become, she broke into a huge, delighted grin and cried,
"Nolly!"
"Oh, crap," said Nall, and he was out of there, with Lakpa in hot pursuit just as fast as she could shape another air scooter.
"So what was that about?"
asked Uchna while the dust settled.
"Well," said Corwin.
2395. Nall fled, noting ruefully as he did that his pursuer was fast for a 4-year-old.
"So cute!"
cried Lakpa in a voice that could have cut glass. Behind, Corwin looked at his mother, who shrugged. 2398. "So I said to the guy," Griffin was saying, when Nall suddenly swooped past his head, across the refectory, and out through a window.
"Come back!"
cried 7-year-old Lakpa, evading the well-meaning arms of several air acolytes like a broken field runner as she crossed the room, bounded onto the last table, and scrambled out through the window after him. Griffin watched her go, then turned back to Cora and remarked dryly, "I didn't know the air nomads were into parkour." 2402. Corwin and Cora sat opposite each other on the meditation pavilion, breathing slowly and evenly, settling gently into the deepest peace within.
"Help!"
cried Nall, speeding past.
"Whee!"
11-year-old Lakpa cheered, banking her glider around the pavilion and shaping an intercept course in an effort to catch him before he reached the temple. Cora slowly opened one eye, registered the figures receding in the distance, and closed it again.
"What was that?" Corwin mumbled.
"Nothing," Cora told him. "Keep breathing." 2404.
"This is just not fair,"
Nall protested, weaving frantically through the airbending gates.
"You will be mine,"
13-year-old Lakpa declared, spinning deftly through the gates herself, then whirled onto an air scooter as soon as she was clear and streaked down the hill after him. Off to the side of the training area, Maki raised an eyebrow at Corwin, who shrugged.
"Ah," said Uchna, enlightened. This time was different.
This time, once he'd recovered from the shock of her sudden appearance, Nall wasn't making a headlong attempt to escape, as he always had before. He was older now, less inclined to panic at the insistent attentions of a girl, particularly one who was, after all, an old friend, and who now looked like that, into the bargain. He let her think he was,
making it look as though he were flying flat out with no particular destination in mind, shouting for help he knew wouldn't come. But in fact he had a very particular destination in mind. He led her a merry chase, nearly a full lap of the island, so that she wouldn't get suspicious. But at last, having adjusted his speed until she was at just the right distance behind, Nall sped toward the airbending gates, knowing that she would see him heading for them and set them spinning to complicate his escape. In doing so, she forced herself to abandon the air scooter so that she could navigate them properly in turn. That slowed her down just enough for Nall to put the next part of his plan into action. Lakpa whirled out of the last gate in record time. She'd have been impressed with her own performance if she'd been of a mind to give it any thought, and pulled up short in consternation. Nall should have been staggering dizzily away from the now slowing gates, having been jostled mercilessly by the air currents, but he was nowhere to be seen. She looked around in puzzlement, calling his name, then nearly jumped out of her skin as something tapped her sharply on the shoulder from behind. She spun, raising her hands in a defensive stance, to see the handsome young man who had turned into Nall, standing just outside the gates, grinning at her. "Got you," he said, in sardonic imitation of the triumphant cry she had always let out of old, when she'd finally caught him and given him his right and proper scruffling. And then she was getting a right and proper scruffling. "In the moment, Lakpa," she thought, remarking wryly to herself that Master Rohan probably hadn't meant it quite this way when he'd taught her that bit of air nomad philosophy, and she relaxed happily into his embrace. As planned, the whole gang regrouped an hour later and rode the evening ferry back to the mainland. Utna, Anthy, and Makoto, and Corwin, Kate and Anne, Amy and Rory, Neri and Serge, Cora, Nima, Nall, and a curiously, contentedly disheveled Lakpa. Anthy perceived an opportunity here for Nima to give back some of the merciless ribbing she'd been receiving from her elder sister about Corwin all weekend long, and was pleased and impressed to see her let it pass by entirely without comment. They dined convivially and well at a middling upscale Earth Kingdom restaurant called, completely unconscious of the standard language joke implied, Chow's. On the way inside, Utna spotted Emily Wong lurking across the street. She nudged Corwin with an elbow, then caught Emily's eye, waved to her, and pointed theatrically at Cora's back as the avatar preceded her into the restaurant, grinning as if to say, "See? Huh? The plot thickens." Night was just falling as, dinner done, they caught the last boat back to Air Temple Island and dispersed to their beds, with a fairly early morning planned for Tuesday. Most of them, anyway. Evening, and Cora was in one of her accustomed haunts, the roof of the White Lotus guardhouse. She wasn't out at the end of the gable ridgepole tonight, but instead back on the pitched part of the roof that also, the building being L-shaped, faced east. Here she could, and often did, spread a blanket over the tiles and sit in the slight concavity of the curved roof. From this vantage point, unlike her perch on the ridgepole, she could lie back and relax, kept from sliding off the roof by its curvature, and take in the view, or look up at the sky, or just doze off. She was looking at the Republic City skyline and mulling over the events of the last few days, the first time she'd really taken the time and space to do that, when she spied a figure walking past the front of the guardhouse below. Whoever it was paused and looked up, as if checking the gable end to see if Cora was up there. She sat up, elbows on knees, and tried to see who it was, but the courtyard in front of the guardhouse was too dark for her to make out any details. A moment later, seeing that she wasn't in her usual spot, the figure turned and started to walk away. In the process, he passed through the little pool of light cast by the guardhouse's front window, and Cora saw that it was Corwin. "Psst,"
Corwin,
she called, keeping her voice down for no real reason other than it seemed the thing to do at this hour.
Over here.
Corwin looked up, peered into the dark, then smiled, his teeth glittering in the window light, and used an earthbending technique to throw himself into the air, depositing himself neatly on the roof a couple of paces away. Not bad, said Cora with a smile, patting the blanket next to her. You make ragged edges, though, she added, pointing to the not very square, upraised chunk of rock he'd left standing in the courtyard. Corwin seated himself next to her. They're a badge of honor in the Beifong style, he replied dryly, then gestured toward his inverse divot and flattened it out again.
Ha! Yeah, I'll buy that, Cora said, settling back against the curve of the roof.
Corwin followed suit, folding his hands on his chest, and they lay side by side and contemplated the Republic City skyline in silence for a while. Then, not unkindly, Cora remarked,
Anthea and Utrina threw you out of their room?
How do you figure? Corwin wondered.
Woman's intuition, said Cora dryly.
Well, since you put so fine a point on it, said Corwin, I have been asked very nicely to find something out of the way to do with myself this evening. He shrugged. Which, after the last couple of days, seems only fair.
So, it's a timeshare kind of thing?
It's a very improvisational kind of thing at the moment, Corwin said.
Fair enough, said Cora.
You're not technically supposed to be over there anyway.
Where do the married air nomads stay when they're passing this way? Corwin wondered. They don't split up for the duration, do they?
Cora shook her head. No, that's what that third building at the back of the courtyard is for. She chuckled at a fond memory. We had to build that after the third and fourth generations started arriving. Aang didn't think of it when he originally built the new air temple. Even though he was doing it himself, that whole marriage and family thing wasn't how the nomads operated when he was a kid. I had to add an entire cliffside just for the foundation space. A pretty monumental day. She hitched herself up on an elbow and looked back over the top of the roof.
Tenzin and Pema used to stay up in the big house by the ornamental pond, and that's where Jinora raised her brood. She offered it to me when her children were all grown and gone, but what am I going to do with a house that size? I'm fine with my room in the ladies' quarters.
Returning to her previous place, she shrugged and added wryly, Not like I'm getting a lot of overnight company.
Speaking of you and the ladies, she added, turning her head to favor him with an arched eyebrow. When did you and the late Toph Beifong get to be such buddies?
Corwin made a lying down shrug.
Well, I don't know. I mean, she's one of those people like, well, like you, actually. I can't remember not knowing her. We sort of took it to the next level last fall, though.
What, while you were stuck in Asgard? Asked Cora.
Right. What happened?
Corwin smiled nostalgically.
She broke into my apartment.
You're really going to have to elaborate on that.
Saturday, September 12th, 2409, Valhalla.
As he had for many evenings lately, Corwin had dozed off on his couch with the television on. He snapped back to consciousness with a jolt at the unexpected sound of a voice, loud and insistent.
Okay, Ravenhair, on your feet. Nap time's over.
Blinking awake, Corwin sat up and saw a familiar, diminutive figure standing four square in the middle of his living room, one of the windows, which had been locked, standing fully open behind her.
It was Toph Beifong, and she was, he realized with deepening puzzlement, dressed for traveling. No shoes, as ever, but she had a heavy cloak over her usual green and tan outfit, and was wearing a hat that looked, if Corwin was being honest, a bit like an overturned wok.
Toph?
He glanced at the TV. The eighth inning of the Knights Rangers game was in progress. He'd fallen asleep in the third. Returning his confused attention to Toph, he asked,
"Why are you breaking into my apartment?"
"I'll tell you why," Toph snapped, her hazy mint-green eyes not quite looking at him. "Because I'm sick of this crap. I'm down at the Golden Axe, and all the Valkyrie girls are crying in their mead about how sad you are, and how mean Frey is, and how sad it all is, and boo-hoo-hoo. Get your ass off that couch, and let's go do something."
Cora snorted.
"Okay, I can see that. And did you? Go do something?"
"Yeah, you could say that," Corwin replied with a chuckle.
"What?"
"Well, see, King Ulfgirth of Jotunheim used to have this green diamond called the Eye of Destiny. Colossal. Got to weigh at least 5 pounds.
"Used to," Cora repeated, smiling slightly.
Corwin nodded.
"Mm-hmm. He kept it in his legendary treasure vault deep beneath Mount Frostcrag, guarded by a legion of his best Jotun troops, and completely unreachable without his magic key besides. Dvergar craftsmanship, that vault. Nothing like it anywhere else in the 9 worlds.
He turned a lazy grin to her and added, "Buried under 2.5 miles of solid rock."
Cora laughed.
"I get the picture," she said.
"A heist can be a great bonding experience," said Corwin philosophically.
"We ought to try it sometime."
"Maybe we should at that."
"One of these days," Corwin mused thoughtfully, "I fully expect to be notified that Toph has single-handedly subjugated the Dvergar of Deeper Svartalfheim and is now their dark and terrible queen, lounging insolently upon a throne of obsidian and gold, while terrified goblins peel grapes for her one at a time. Given some stories I've heard about what she got up to back in the day, I wouldn't be surprised," Cora admitted. She thought in silence for a few moments, then said,
"Hey, Corwin?"
"Yeah?"
Leaning up on one elbow, Cora gave him a serious look and said,
"I need you to level with me about something."
"Okay.
Do you know Katara? Is she in Valhalla too, like Toph?"
Corwin hesitated, but only for a second.
"Yes."
Cora sat back again and turned her face up to the sky, closing her eyes. A few seconds later, without opening them, she said in a level voice,
"I'm going to assume there's a good reason you never told me about her."
"She asked me not to," Corwin replied. "Many years ago. She made me promise never to tell you, unless you specifically asked."
"Why?"
"She didn't want to put me in a position where I'd have to lie to you," he said. Cora shook her head, eyes still closed.
"No, I mean, why not let you tell me? I'd have been thrilled."
"I am thrilled, but also confused." She sat up and turned to face him suddenly, her eyes glinting wetly in the moonlight.
"Corwin, I loved that woman like she was my grand-grand," she said. "I saw more of her growing up than my own parents. And now, why would she hide this from me?"
I asked her that when she made me promise not to tell you, said Corwin soberly. I still remember what she said. I was, what, 6 or 7? I had just put it together, that she was the Katara you had told me about, and I was all excited. I was going to get Mom to bring you to Valhalla, and you'd get to see her again. He closed his eyes. I can see her. How sad she looked. Tuesday, February 17th, 2398. Valhalla. Katara lowered herself to one knee to meet Corwin's eyes, putting her hands on his shoulders, and spoke to him as if to appear. No, Corwin, you mustn't do that. You mustn't even tell her I'm here. Corwin frowned, confused. Why not? She'd be really happy. She misses you. Katara bowed her head for a moment, unable to reply. Then she looked him in the eye again and said, I know she would, and I'd love to see her again. But your mother must have taught you. There's a dividing line between the world of the living and this place for a reason. You can walk on either side of it because of who you are, but for the rest of us, no. No, Korra has to keep moving forward. She mustn't be tempted to dwell on what was. My time has passed for her. It's best if it stays that way. I can't lie to her, Corwin objected, faintly indignant, partly as a way of covering the fact that he was none the wiser for her explanation. No, I wouldn't ask you to do that, Katara assured him. Only, promise me you won't mention me. If she asks you directly, or finds out some other way, of course you can tell her the truth. But promise me it won't come from you. Filled with misgivings, but unable to refuse such a direct request from a friend, Corwin hesitated, then said, All right. I promise. They sat gazing at each other in a solemn silence for a few seconds. Then Korra let out a faint snort and lay back again, one arm across her forehead. Well, that's just dumb, she said grumpily. I don't think so, said Corwin, mirroring her posture with both hands behind his head. I mean, I don't think she's right. But I can understand why she would think she was. Most people wouldn't be able to cope with direct knowledge of the afterlife. She should have known better when it comes to you, but... Well, you said it yourself. She knew you when you were just a little kid, all enthusiasm and no judgment. On some level, that's how she still sees you. It's human nature. He quirked a little smile at her. Be honest, how many times in the last 3 days have you had to remind yourself I'm not the great bison hijacker anymore? In spite of herself, Korra laughed. You have a point. Doubly so when I consider how strange it feels that you're over there being all wise and mature at me, she added with a wry grin. I mean, I know it's because of not seeing you in a while. But to me it's like you've just suddenly grown up all at once. Here we are like old times, shooting the breeze on the guardhouse roof, except all of a sudden we're talking about heavy, grown-up things, and it's just odd. She looked over at him and half-smiled. Nice, but odd. She sighed, gathering her thoughts, then went on. You're right, you know. That's my main problem, even with people who haven't been, out of circulation for as long as Katara has. I look the same as I did when I first came to Republic City. On a lot of levels, I feel the same, but it's not all it's cracked up to be. I mean, I like being healthy, don't get me wrong, but
it colors people's perceptions of me sometimes. Even people who I saw grow up, to the point where they forget I'm older than they are. At which point, well, you get things like what Tenek got up to. She shook her head. If they'd only bothered to talk it over with me, face to face, maybe we could have reached some kind of compromise or something. I'd have been willing to take it slow, study the angles. Instead, we got 5 years of nothing but letters, and then Kiyoshi trashing the meeting room. Corwin chuckled. Well, hey, look on the bright side, he said. You must have mellowed her some. Time was, there would have been structural damage. Yeah, true. Cora lapsed into silent thought for a few moments, then asked, Do you ever ask your dad how he does it? What, you mean be 400 years old? I tried once. His answer wasn't that illuminating. He shrugged and said, Hell, I don't know, son. It just kind of happened while I was doing other stuff. Cora laughed again. Yeah, that sounds like Griff, she said. Still, at least it's a more upbeat answer than the one I got. You ask Dad about the lifespan thing? Corwin asked. I never heard about that. Seems weird that he'd have given you a downer of an answer. Even when he gets into a dark corner, which happens sometimes, the fact that he's still going is usually one of his bright spots, if you see what I mean. She smiled, nodding. Yeah, I hear you. I wasn't thinking about him, though. I was thinking about the first time I seriously explored the question. That was before I met your father, long before. My 100th birthday was the first time I really stared hard at it. And back then there was only one person I could ask. I asked Kiyoshi. Corwin looked askance at her. Seriously? Sinti U, Sinue 14th, 253 ASC. Friday, April 14th, 2372 GSC. The Spirit World. Every time Cora entered the spirit world, it was subtly different, and this time was no exception. She found herself sitting in an open field, surrounded by rocky crags that were streaked with pastel chalk veins thrusting out of the terrain. The air was thick with the scent of clover, and dandelion spirits drifted with the breeze. Cora nodded to herself, got to her feet, and looked around. In the distance, she could see rolling hills reaching for the turquoise and violet sky. Yes, this would do nicely. Putting thumb and forefinger in the corners of her mouth, Cora let out a piercing whistle that echoed out over the landscape. She waited for a few moments, and then smiled as an eager howl answered back. Leaning against one of the rock outcroppings, Cora only had to wait a few moments before she saw movement on the horizon. A low, wide, white something rapidly approached, resolving itself into many narrower somethings, preceded by more howls and barks. "There you are!" Cora exclaimed, stepping away from the rock and spreading her arms wide, as an entire pack of polar bear dogs surrounded her, each one eager for their master's touch. She laughed as they nearly overwhelmed her. As it was, she was forced back down to a sitting position, as she was obliged to scratch and rub the proffered muzzles and foreheads of her loyal companions.
Hey, leave some of me for the rest of them, Ati.
Wow, Nuvia, do you ever need a bath? Caught any good fish lately, Imani? Keeping your claws sharp, Amaruk? You're definitely getting exercise, aren't you, Inruk? Cora grinned as she gave each of the bear dogs a warm welcome, reassuring them she was there, remembered their names, still cared about them. Finally, there was but one left,
and she got to her feet as the last polar bear dog nuzzled her. Cora smiled sadly, brushing tears from her eyes before she embraced the giant dog around her wide neck.
Oh, Naga, I've missed you so much.
She buried her face in the thick white fur, just breathing in Naga's scent, before pulling back to look her in the eye.
I'm sorry for being away so long.
Ack! Hey!
Cora blurted out as Naga licked her face and her tears away in the process.
No hard feelings, huh?
Cora asked with a tired smile. Naga barked and nuzzled her cheek.
Thank you.
Taking a deep breath, Cora stretched, then swung up into Naga's saddle, which hadn't been there a moment before, situating herself as she always had. Below her, the rest of the pack looked up at her expectantly.
Sorry, guys and gals, but I'm afraid this one's me and Naga only,
Cora apologized. Before the pack could voice its protest, she gestured off into the middle distance.
Look, I'm sure if you stay together, you can run down some Rabaru spirits off that-a-way without problems.
Ati appeared to find this a fine idea, and with a final bark and licking of Cora's booted ankle, she turned and led the pack off. Cora watched them depart, then leaned down and murmured into Naga's ear.
Let's go find Kyoshi, Naga. Let's ride.
It was impossible to measure how much time it took for Cora and Naga to track down the prior Earth Kingdom avatar. Such things mattered little this deep in the spirit world, and if questioned, Cora would have had to admit she didn't really mind. It had been far too long since she had last spent time with her first-ever friend, and she savored the journey as they searched the varied landscapes. Finally, they found themselves traveling through a bamboo forest. Through a gap in the bamboo stems, they could see the glimmer of the ocean beyond.
This looks promising,
Cora murmured and urged Naga forward. The polar bear dog quickly found a path through the forest that hadn't been there before, and followed it eagerly as the bamboo stands parted before them. What awaited them was a clearing along the crest of a hilly ridgeline. The hills fell down sharply towards the ocean beyond, and the bamboo groves thinned out. If Cora narrowed her eyes and squinted, she could see a long, serpentine creature among the offshore islands. It looked like an unagi, but she couldn't tell for sure, and in the spirit world it could have represented almost anything. Still, the place felt right. Cora dismounted, scratched Naga behind the ears, and looked around. The clearing was landscaped in the Earth Kingdom style, with carefully spaced rocks, plantings, and the occasional stone bench. Amid them stood a tall woman dressed in green, a golden headdress above her painted face. Curiously, she was standing before an easel and wielding a paintbrush instead of one of her customary golden war fans. Cora arched an eyebrow, gestured for Naga to stay at the edge of the clearing, and stepped forward to get Avatar Kyoshi's attention.
If you are wondering why you are not aging, Cora, I cannot help you. Such matters were beyond our understanding in my time as Avatar, and I severely doubt the same circumstances apply to you,
Kyoshi said, not moving her focus from the landscape painting she was working on.
You would do better to talk with one of the air nomads, like Yangchen, who divorced themselves from worldly affairs and accepted that their ends would come at the appointed time.
I wasn't going to ask about that, actually, Cora pointed out. She quirked a grin as the taller woman was brought up short. This was a moment to be savored. Kyoshi blinked.
Oh, I see.
She set her brush down and regarded her successor.
But still you are troubled.
Cora nodded and walked over to the nearby bench, sitting down with a sigh.
Yeah, I am. It's not the how or why of not getting old that's worrying me. It's just, how do you deal with it? Living so long.
She shook her head and gestured out toward the ocean beyond. Mom and Dad, Master Tenzin and Pema, they've all long passed away. Jinora and the air babies.
Cora snorted derisively. It's ridiculous to even call them that anymore. Spirits. Jinora's got great-grandchildren now. And Asami, Bolin, Mako.
She closed her eyes tight, and her fists briefly clenched at her sides.
Well, we've gone over all that before.
Kiyoshi curtly nodded and moved over to the bench.
If I may, Cora?
Cora nodded, opening her eyes and relaxing her hands to gesture at the empty space next to her.
Sure, it's a free spirit world.
The elder avatar sat down next to her successor, the folds of her ornate kimono settling around her.
In my time, it was rare for people to live as long as they do now in Dicho. To say I was an anomaly would be severely understating the issue. Even before I attained my great age, I already stood apart from most people of my era thanks to my height, and it was only enhanced when I was announced as the Avatar.
Cora frowned briefly. Strangely, that sounds oddly familiar.
Kiyoshi nodded.
Your own isolation due to the early realization of your abilities, yes. She looked out towards the island peaks, her expression grim behind her warrior's face paint.
I made being the Avatar my watchword, acknowledged it as the reason for my existence. I sought to be a mountain, persistent and enduring, embodying the substance of Earth. The world would change around me, but I would not. My justice would stand when all other options failed.
Cora considered this.
Makes sense, I suppose. But it sounds awfully lonely.
I made some connections, of course. That sort of thing is inevitable in any but the most cloistered life, and I was never a monk. But I always strove to hold others at arm's length, so they wouldn't distract me from my duties, and so that when the time came to let them go, it would be easier.
Cora shook her head. I don't think I can live like that, not after everything I've done and seen.
Then you will suffer, Kyoshi replied, bluntly but not unkindly.
It cannot be avoided. You already know that. If you choose to go on facing it again and again anyway, then perhaps you are braver than I.
Cora arched a curious eyebrow up at her predecessor.
Really? How do you figure?
As I was the mountain, you are the ocean, Cora. Kiyoshi nodded toward the waves beyond and the sea spirits that dwelled there.
Like the ocean itself, you change, yet remain the same as the world turns. You embody water. Your strength is in the connections you make, the people that you love. It is from your community, whatever form it takes, that you will draw strength in the long run.
Cora blinked, then blinked again, and then nodded, finally allowing herself to smile.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I get it now.
She chuckled, straightening up.
Not that I didn't learn the lesson before, the hard way, but it's always good to have a refresher.
Cora got up from the bench, turned, and performed the Water Tribe salute as she bowed toward the taller woman.
Thank you, Avatar Kiyoshi, for your wisdom.
Kiyoshi smiled slightly as she stood,
clasped her hands together, and returned the bow.
It was my honor to aid you, Avatar Korra.
Korra's eyebrows went nearly up to her hairline. She honestly could not recall Kyoshi having smiled, ever, in her past or those of Aang or Roku.
Okay, what's that you're not telling me, Kyoshi?
It was a thought told to me once by Yangchen, that if your answers were not to be found here or in Dicho, then perhaps they could be found elsewhere. For centuries, I had thought it just air nomad rambling, but given recent developments, then perhaps I should look elsewhere, or in this case, elseworld.
Korra chuckled and gestured for Naga to approach.
Yangchen always did play all the angles, didn't she? She continued, swinging up into her companion's saddle.
Kyoshi nodded in agreement.
Indeed.
Again, thank you, Kyoshi,
Korra replied, giving her predecessor one last look.
I will keep your words to heart.
Kyoshi returned Korra's gaze.
Thank you.
Safe travels, Korra. And with that, Korra and Naga departed.
Wow, Corwin mused. You have mellowed her.
Hey, this was years before you came along, God Boy, said Korra, giving him a nudge with her elbow. She's just like that with you because she doesn't approve of you.
What possible reason could she have not to approve of me? Corwin wondered indignantly.
Search me. Maybe she thinks you're a flighty young man who will tempt me to run away with him and leave my world in the lurch.
Corwin scowled at that, then snorted, giggled, outright laughed as a thought dawned upon him.
Yes? Korra wondered.
I just realized what we should have done, said Corwin, coming down from the fit of laughter with a long sigh. When we came back from Sephiro, we should have convened the White Lotus Masters right then and there, gone in, and told them the whole thing was a smokescreen, and we eloped. You and me. Just to see what they would do.
Korra stared at him for a few seconds as if he'd just declared his ambition to be the next Fire Lord. Then, just as it had him, the thought made her first snicker, then giggle, then give up and let fly a hearty burst of laughter.
Oh, man, she said when she'd recovered. We totally should have. That would have been epic.
Although, she added wryly, I suspect Captain Mrs. Prince Ravenhair Tenjo wouldn't have approved.
You would be amazed at the measures Utrina will approve of when the goal is to stick it to an interfering bureaucracy, Corbin told her.
I mean, don't get me wrong. She'd expect you to take your turn on dish duty and stuff, just like everybody else. Being the Avatar doesn't get you a pass on the household business.
Korra giggled.
I'll be sure to note that for my files, she said, then elbowed him.
Have you started on her betrothal necklace yet?
How did you know about that? He wondered.
Cousin Kemba likes to talk, said Korra mischievously.
Ah, of course. Well, no, actually. I'm still thinking about the design. Which reminds me, I'm going to need another set of those materials. Heck, in Anthe's case, I've still got a chance to do it in the right order for once.
Sort of.
Korra snorted.
Yeah, you're not going to find step one, father-child, on many of the standard checklists, but...
He shrugged. Her idea, not mine.
He smiled, a bit dreamily, at the star-splashed sky. Although I have to admit I've warmed to the notion somewhat.
Korra chuckled. I can tell.
Which reminds me, Corwin said, his voice slightly drowsy now. Since she said it to you up on the dueling floor, Anthy likes to call you my imaginary friend. But it'd be closer to the truth to call you my fairy godmother. In a world where fairies are hardcore ass-kickers, anyway. And actually, some of them are. We've got one in the Valkyrie who can drop a giant at 200 yards. But I digress. Anyway, my point is, Avatar Korra, Anthy asked me to tell you that we'd be beyond honored if you'd do the same for our daughter. He shook his head. Not the fairy part, that was just me wandering. Korra turned her head and regarded his profile with a sentimental smile, then reached across the small space between them and took his hand, the gesture one of plain, uncomplicated affection. "The honor," she said softly, "would be mine, Prince Corwin."